Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 177 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, poet Judy Brown considers how two decades spent as a practicing lawyer have impacted her experiences and processes of writing, and considers the parallels and contrasts between the law and poetry. Following Judy, poet and novelist Martina Evans considers her unlikely literary beginnings as the youngest of 10 in a County Cork family. I was known as a dreamer, a fumbler, a fool. If I was so busy dreaming, how did I notice so many things? My family asked this question too, even then. First, here's Judy Brown with Working Behind Glass.
In 2013, after a reading at the Wordsworth Trust, where I was poet in residence, I was asked whether anything from the years I'd spent working as a lawyer had informed my poems. It was a good question, and a fair one, since I'd only left law the year before, from my astute editor Amy Wack of Sarin, but I didn't seem able to reply at all, let alone provide an honest conclusion. I'm tempted to deny the connection, though I think there's a more interesting answer than nothing. I spent over 20 years in legal firms in the city and in Hong Kong before I became a full-time writer. Most of that time I wasn't writing poems, and when I began to do so, the two fields slowly proved their incompatibility, for me at least. I read a good interview with the poet Mona Arshi in The Lawyer about the intersection of her previous career as a human rights lawyer with her life in poetry. She touches on linguistic discipline. That's the clear link. Other than that, as a human rights lawyer, her experiences were very different than mine. I'd specialised in banking and finance law, for the first 5 years working with clients on their transactions. Then later, I spent my time drafting documents, teaching, researching. There was always a lot of writing. Having worked, and for so long, at something which values many things I find disturbing, I want to deny that law exerted any osmotic pressure across the wall that separated it from poetry. Another reason might be, it sounds dull, all that clerking, despite the foreign travel. I found it more frightening than dull. At the very least, those years taught me something of the hidden armatures that underlie many things that are forced on us, the operational rules of a world that we never quite understand. Law is one of those armatures, and it's strange to find yourself making sense of it. Philip Larkin talks about life ending up as what something hidden from us chose, and that works on a global scale too. Disturbingly, and probably unfairly, I'm reminded of an image which might be as shocking and unforgettable to you as it was to me. The experiment where a baby monkey is given a hard wire structure that gives out milk and a cuddly cloth mother. The monkey fed at the wire structure but spent the rest of its time holding on to the soft cloth mother. Can the two lives be that polarised? After another reading, a practicing lawyer questioned my poor career choices, telling me, "Everyone feels like that in their early 40s. You just have to get your head down and you come out the other side. You've thrown everything away for nothing." What a fool I'd been to choose the cuddly mother, at least when I could have had access to both. Of course, there were long-term lawyer poets, Roy Fuller, Wallace Stevens, who worked as a surety lawyer. The Dark Horse, a poetry magazine edited by RLF fellow Jerry Cambridge, reprinted an article about Stevens' legal career, written by Juliet Moran, a trained chemist who had worked as a manager in business. In it, she argues that, in important ways, Stevens' poetry was informed by his career as an insurance lawyer, and that some of the qualities of poets, language skills, self-confidence, flowed across the border, but also that lawyerly discretion, detachment, and a need for hermeticism flowed into the poetry. Nevertheless, John Burnside quotes Stevens writing to his fiancée, "I certainly do not exist from 9 to 6 when I'm at the office." The commercial and finance law I did meant drafting lots of contracts. there was also much explaining of the more counterintuitive aspects of English law. The law we worked with could be Dickensian. Sometimes old cases full of peculiar specificity underpinned quite modern financial structures. The cargoes of ships, symbolic commodities such as gold and wine, family tussles over Downton-style properties. This kind of law looked at how things are agreed, including what you're not allowed to agree because it's unfair, and the law of land and things, owning things, taking mortgages over things, getting things back when other people have got them. I think there's probably a metaphorical charge in some of this. Invented pragmatic creatures such as companies, the very nature of objects, and whether they're unique or simply some kind of interchangeable commodity. How merchandise is transformed from one substance into another. Conflicting legal forces, including the laws of several countries, tugging and clawing at the same person or object. Even ignoring that legal agreements can be very one-sided and unfair, there's one obvious way in which the law is the opposite of poetry. It has to limit language to do its job. A contract will define keywords that are to be used in it, chopping away at the complexity, ambiguity, and historic freight words bear. One of the excitements of a great poem can be the way it uses all the rich resources that are encoded in even ordinary words. If the poet is skillful, the one or more things a word denotes, and the wider cloud of associations surrounding a word, can all be playing in the mind of the reader without harming the poem's ability to communicate. The same word will reflect light differently, depending on context, and may, when used multiple times, mean something quite different on each occasion. And the same object will be examined and complicated by the nuances of the various words used to describe it. This is real trust. Legal words might, ideally, be as attenuated as vaccines, obedient creatures engineered for the purpose of that contract. Their tails are docked in the contract's interpretation section. In this agreement, the following words have the following meanings. All other meanings are sliced away, and sometimes some unexpected ones added. In a contract, you'll always use the same word to mean the same thing. Only one interpretation can triumph. There must be no doubt as to the contract's meaning. The way a poem releases secondary meanings over time is anathema. Nevertheless, lawyers respect words. Contractual language can really make something happen in the world. I learned to see writing as active, even violent, and liable to misunderstanding. Sometimes Parliament needs to intervene to defuse the crueler demands a contract might make. Because legal documents are something rather than just saying something, they alter reality. That gave me a nightmare-inducing fear of even minor mistakes. I would wake in the night reading the document I was drafting off the pages of my brain and know there's something wrong in clause 3. That subconscious, or do I mean compulsive, editing will be familiar to writers. Awareness of the dangerous importance of minutiae is common ground between writing and my old life. The fear hasn't gone, but it helps me as a poet to take carelessness seriously. I thought too of how much, as a contract lawyer, I distrusted my readers. A poem can't work if it doesn't expand, flower, and be completed in the mind of the reader. The poet hopes for, even needs, cooperation, and has to assume that the reader will put in some work to make the poem her own. A contract is in part designed to cover the situation where cooperation breaks down, so it may well state the obvious, to avoid a disgruntled business partner challenging that obviousness. When drafting a contract, I had a strong, even exaggerated sensation of the presence of a hostile misreader. Could you even write a poem in this state of mind? However much you edit your poems to prevent things like double entendres that you don't want, you don't imagine the reader suing you. I think, though, I sometimes do. I certainly still imagine my poems being pressure tested, frisked for unclarity and mistake, believing I'll lose my job if I let a tiny glitch slip in. That contracts are called agreements hides the fact that once signed by the parties, they give orders. They're binding, a good prison metaphor. They're more than just conversation or description. They tell you how it's going to be. To write poems, I've given up many sorts of control. I think it helps to embrace the powerlessness that accompanies the trade, even if you acquire another sort of arrogance. It starts to seem ironic that there's a kind of poem that pretends to be an instruction, because of course, how could it be? A classic book on contractual interpretation talks about how a contract is performative, a speech act which makes something happen. Everything is subject to the hereby that used to begin things. But that's true of poems too. They do something, they are something, they bring things to life. I find too that I still draw metaphors from law in disturbing contexts, and I'm not sure this is a good thing. The law's harsh, abstract-sounding terms, frustration, forfeiture, enforcement, foreclosure, breach, have a heavy reality for me. More practically, the image of a contract, with its connotations of failure to perform, enforcement and amendment, comes a bit too easily to hand. Many implicit agreements harden into contracts in my mind. Just as a supermarket might make an open offer to shoppers that they'll sell the goods on their shelves to anyone who pays the stated price, the poem's first line might be an open offer to the reader that is accepted by reading on, i.e. that it will deliver certain things or certain other things which are just as good or better. The idea of a poem breaching its contract with its reader, because it seems to offer more than it delivers, has a dark side in my imagination. Promises feel like contracts to me. In either case, the false promiser exposes themselves to action. Poems, promises, contracts signed in blood. This is not the soft cloth mother. I've talked so far about things which are relevant to many types of contracts, but the contracts I saw on a daily basis mostly concern money, another abstraction holding an often misspent power. By 2014, I felt readier to look this in the eye and was granted a residency at Gladstone's Library based on a proposal to research and write some poems touching on aspects of law and money. It's hard not to be alert to the false claim money makes for neutrality. How different it is in law to how it is in our hands and in our lives. Most of the classic symbolism of money comes from physical money, the piles of gold coins and the dogs with huge eyes in the fairy tale, or the tallow-tainted banknote. In Gladstone Library's amazing idiosyncratic collection, I read how coins were made and discovered David Graeber's astonishing book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years. This, among many other things, showed how ensuring, even engineering, that people fell into debt made it possible to coerce human beings in physical ways which you could not otherwise justify. Images from this book are still haunting my poems. I'll be rereading it many times. I was particularly interested in how money connects things which are totally different by allowing you to compare the values ascribed to them. It's the universal solvent. Poetry has a magical quality of revealing the connections between things which appear superficially to belong to quite different categories. It's not hard to see money as the dark image of poetry. Wallace Stevens's comment that money is a kind of poetry is often quoted. The poet Sam Riviere says some interesting things about this in an interview in Review 31. He says, "Money and poetry do seem connected in obvious and obscure ways. The way money is an entirely voided symbol, like a metaphor with no target or source or something." Rebecca Solnit draws on David Graeber's thought that money makes us separate bodies, and maybe it teaches us that we should be separate. I wonder if I would have found this quite so sharply resonant if I hadn't worked in an arena which followed the travels of money into realms which seemed abstract, but of course weren't. So the answer to Amy Wack's question was yes and no. There were things about years spent writing contracts that toughened me up. I'm still good at staying up all night to work. I've always been used to living by my words and being ready to be held to account for my failures. And some of the law's arcane concepts, which may seem both abstract and personally threatening, have a harsher, more intense symbolism the more you understand how they work. I also value poems about work, since some types of work are so hermetic as well as quotidian. I'd hate to return to law, but I do know, to paraphrase Claire Crowther's poem, Ubi Sunt, what it might mean to be one of those people who says, I worked my whole life behind glass. I want to end on the idea of partiality. Jeanette Moran's article talks about Wallace Stevens's discretion. I find secrets terrifying. As a lawyer, your duty to keep your client's affairs secret is both a real and a symbolic weight. I took the idea of having a client seriously. They instruct you, and you owe them. A reader's someone you might not be thinking about in the early creation of a poem, but once you start editing, you don't lose sight of them. I'm glad the reader's not a client, even while they're reading the poem, even when they've paid for the book. To stretch the analogy to Twangling Point, I guess poetry's the client. Maybe every poem has its secrets, but I like to think of those as more like the secrets of a carpenter or a builder, the superstitious pair of old boots buried for good luck under the floorboards of a house. In other ways, I want my poems to be indiscreet, to break open secrets. I want them to be as well made as legal documents, but otherwise as unlike as can be.
That was Judy Brown. You can find out more about Judy on her website at judy-brown.co.uk. Next, here's Martina Evans with What Happens When We're Looking Away.
I've always been obsessed with doubles and pairs. My favourite novels teem with pairs and doppelgangers and two-faced characters. Wuthering Heights, The Secret Sharer, My Cousin Rachel, Jekyll and Hyde, Long John Silver. The best poems are pulled tight in two directions, so it's no wonder that the sonnet with its dramatic shift or rhetorical volta has lasted so long. The sonnet sets up a line of thought or feeling which turns on its head before it comes to an end. In a Petrarchan sonnet, this turn usually happens around line 8. The Shakespearean sonnet turns around line 12, but it can happen anywhere between these two poles. That conflict seems to be part of the human character. We're never one thing or another in the same way that the lyric can never be totally separated from narrative. The sweeping, devastating narrative of W.B. Yeats' Leda and the Swan can't be separated from its time freeze of a terrifying white-feathered rape. Poetry's greatest gift is in the way it uses sound and image to resolve our oppositions. And it seems to me sometimes that the chiaroscuro of classical black and white films like Murnau's Faust, for instance, come close to that settlement of the expression of opposites. And writing itself, it's back to back. Jane is faced with reading. Like so many writers, it was reading that inspired me to write. Our fingers start to itch. We want to join in. In the same way that health fanatics tell us we are what we eat, writers are what we read. But when it comes to health, genetics really count too. The same applies to writing. I grew up the youngest of an intense storytelling family of 10. Apart from my eldest brother, they weren't literary, and most of them weren't serious readers. They didn't need to be, busy as they were performing live on the stage of our County Cork bar and shop. I craved privacy, which was in short supply, and although we did have our private moments, even they had a habit of getting exposed, as in my poem, Facing the Public, where my mother's private stories about customers are revealed when the shop bell doesn't work. How often we became aware of that silent listener when he betrayed himself with a creak, a sneeze or a cough. How long had he been standing, waiting in the shop? We looked at each other with haunted faces. I, being the youngest, would get the task of serving him, his jar of old-time Irish, his quarter pound of ham. Writing his messages into the book, red-faced and dumb, before his replete and amused look. Meanwhile inside, my mother held a tea towel to her brow. Never, never, never would she be able, as long as she lived, even if she got Ireland free in the morning, no, 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 she would never be able to face the public again. Family history reports that I taught myself to read at the age of 3. If memory can be trusted, I can remember the day very clearly. I crept into a dusty bedroom to search for Inna Blyton's green storybook. There was always work to do, and worse than that, older siblings to tell me how to do it and where I was going wrong. If I was still too young to work at that stage, I needed desperately to escape. and here it was that somehow the black marks on a white page straightened out into sense and opened the door. A chocoholic elf got himself locked inside a giant Easter egg. It was the image of a giant Easter egg that captured me. I could smell it, taste it, imagine myself trapped in the chocolatey darkness. And it was the image, the predicament, that stayed with me, not the method of escape. As I worked my way through old 50s red-backed Famous Five books, I was simultaneously discovering poetry in a set of old green crumbling volumes stamped with gold harps. A collection of Irish literature that came all the way from Australia, where my family lived before I was born. I leafed through, looking for poems, lighting up when I saw the white space around the text that denoted verse. The rhythm of William Allingham's Up the Airy Mountain transfixed me with its incantatory rhythm and the mysterious tale of a stolen child. To this day, I am fascinated by the sinister side of Irish fairy lore. Groundbreaking writers like Hubert Butler, author of the fascinating essay The Eggman and the Fairies, and Angela Burke, who wrote The Burning of Bridget Cleary, reveal how these superstitions could be the outward manifestation of social problems, ranging from jealousy to child abduction, domestic violence and incest. Like Grimm's tales, the Irish fairies are a way into the murky unconscious of a collective imagination. Born in 1919, my mother must still have come across these superstitions, known as pishogues. But apart from one time when she let something slip about hares, she refused to speak about them. Looking back, I see now that this refusal was part of some kind of terror, fear of being seen to be superstitious, and something else I can't put my finger on. What could be more powerful than that? There was an Australian school anthology which was also green. Green is the coarse carpet which left tiny round marks on my knees when I knelt to read in our barely used upstairs sitting room. I knelt in awe before D.H. Lawrence's Snake, found myself transported to Italy on a hot, hot day, and I in pyjamas for the heat. I am still haunted by this tale of transgression, where the poet throws a log at the mesmerising guest who came to drink at his water trough. I couldn't escape the feeling that it was I who had thrown the log against the gold snake. My childhood knowledge of snakes was non-existent, apart from the fact they were next door to the devil. I lived in fear of a statue of the Virgin that stood over the stairs, her foot crushing the snake's head. If I had seen a snake, I was sure I would have thrown a log too, but not after reading this poem, which took me from Burnford Bar, County Cork, to another world. And as I remember this now, my mind has left my bed in London and I am in two places, Lawrence's Italy and my childhood Burnford Bar, even though neither place exists anymore. As I was thinking about this talk, time melted away and I forgot to keep my eye on the tyrannical digital clock in the upper right-hand corner of my laptop. I managed to outwit time for a brief period. These days I return quickly, but when I was a child, I would fall through the page and into a trance. My eyes never came back to rest on any clock until someone shouted and broke in. I was addicted and no one could stop me. They tried. A local customer spoke of how when my sister flung my book across the shop floor when I didn't hop to it to serve the crowd rushing in from mass, my first concern was to retrieve it and mark the page. My most serious offence, remembered for years, was the rolling of oranges. I stood at the shop counter rolling oranges to a customer with my right hand, my eyes fixed on the book in my left hand. I often think of this when I stand in my local shop, buying cans of Dr. Pepper from an assistant who serves me while talking to someone in Turkey via a phone pressed to his ear. It's acceptable these days to be elsewhere, but in my childhood it was a grave offence and I got into terrible trouble. The master at school beat me brutally when he found me far away in Treasure Island. I've written about it in the prose poem O Bart. Unaware of the hurricane of spit and hands hurtling towards my head, and I still feel it, the black and white shock, back and forth, back and forth, my head in his hands like a ball. And when it was over and I raised the latch, stumbling through Burnford, like blind Pew, tapping along the road. I grew up and left home, knowing I could never write until I put the Irish Sea between myself and Burnford. And what did I write about? The place which I'd gone to so much trouble to escape from. Burnford. It never goes away. A seam of memory that stretches as the years advance. I know it sounds dramatic to say I escaped. It wasn't World War II. Everyone leaves home. But at the same time, I know I am my mother's daughter. Her sense of drama haunts my poetry in the heart and soul of Burnford Bar. I was known as a dreamer, a fumbler, a fool. If I was so busy dreaming, how did I notice so many things? My family asked this question too, even then. I had a habit of coming out with embarrassing observations. "And we thought you were going round in a dream," they would say. I must have been doing two things at once. Reading, and remembering forever the details of a place which time has changed so much that I have as little chance of visiting it as I have of finding D.H. Lawrence's Italy. That is why I keep returning, circling back. I would never describe my childhood as idyllic, yet Thomas Hardy seems to have his thumb on the spot in his wonderful ballad, The Self Unseeing. This poem effortlessly evokes the vivid musical dream our life assumes when we look back, transfixed. The Self Unseeing. Here is the ancient floor, foot-worn and hollowed and thin. Here was the former door where the dead feet walked in. She sat here in her chair, smiling into the fire. He who played stood there, bowing it higher and higher. Childlike I danced in a dream, blessings emblazoned that day. Everything glowed with a gleam, yet we were looking away. Looking back, it's hard to believe how I ever managed to become a published writer. I wanted to study English, but my family wanted me to train as a radiographer. I did, but I also had a book in the pocket of my white uniform, studying for an open university degree in English and philosophy, while spending many sleepless nights on call, taking x-rays and scanning brains. I didn't know the first thing about writing novels, but I knew about reading them. Where did I get the faith to sit down and write my first draft when I was aged 29 and pregnant? Somehow, 4 years later, while working at the Whittington Hospital and Pentonville Prison, as well as taking care of a baby, I had a two-book deal with Sinclair Stevenson. I do know one of the factors that drove me, though, the ticking clock. I had begun to publish poems in magazines, and although part of me thought, and still does, that radiography and poetry could be quite an interesting combination, my daughter Leodan was growing up. I wanted to be around for her childhood, not farming her out while I worked in X-ray. Radiography hours are not child-friendly. Leodan suffered from asthma too, which miraculously disappeared the minute I escaped from the X-ray department. I hardly need to say that X-rays have begun to haunt my poetry now, 21 years since I left. I was busy studying and reading during my 15 years in the NHS, but the black and white skeleton was on every X-ray I took, the classical image of time or death, and it's calling me now, as those 24-hour on-call sessions have become a dream sequence of poems on feet, following on from a sonnet sequence written about shoes that I never thought I'd remember. Even the most insignificant footwear walked out of the past in the last year, lining up to tap out their own dance.
That was Martina Evans. You can find out more about Martina on her website at www.martinaevans.com. And that concludes episode 177, which was recorded by Julia Copus and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 178, in the second half of their two-part interview, novelist Conan Jones speaks with James McConaughey about the square mile in Welsh culture, the experience of retelling stories, and the spark that sends him to the writing shed to get a pending novel down on the page. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.